and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, the endangered belugas in Cook Inlet. Recorded at the Wildlife Wednesday lecture series, Dr. Leslie Cornick from the Department of Environmental Science at Alaska Pacific University presented new information from recent studies on the Cook Inlet beluga at the Alaska Zoo on December 14th.
To our Wildlife Wednesday program this evening. Our partners which make this program possible are the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Geographic, and of course the Alaska Zoo. So again, we thank our partners and you for joining us for our program this evening. Our speaker for the evening is Dr. Leslie Cornick. She is an Associate Professor of Marine Biology and Policy at Alaska Pacific University. She's originally from Southern California, where she obtained a BA in Biological Anthropology from UC San Diego and her Master's in Physiology and Behavior Biology from San Francisco State University. She did her PhD at Texas A&M University, studying optimal foraging in stellar sea lions in Alaska. Following her PhD, she remained in Alaska to do her postdoctoral research at UAF, which took her to opposite polar regions of Antarctica. After leaving for a year to teach in Connecticut, she returned to Alaska to APU. Dr. Cornick's research has focused largely on interdisciplinary approaches to examining the physiological constraints of foraging in marine predators and the flexibility of foraging behavior in response to natural and anthropogenic changes in the environment. She is also very concerned about impacts of human activity on the marine environment, particularly in Alaska, where climate change and coastal zone and offshore development threaten Alaska's living marine resources. Dr. Cornick currently has projects working with NMFS and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and others examining health and condition in beluga whales, and her program conducts scientific marine mammal monitoring for the Fort and Anchorage expansion project. She is also continuing her work with sea lions, monk seals, and sea otters. And here is Dr. Leslie Cornick.
Thank you, Stephanie. So I have to apologize right off the bat. As you can tell, I'm recovering from laryngitis. So this is my impression of Betty Davis giving a talk on beluga whales. So thank you very much for coming. I'm really excited to be here. I have really expanded my horizons so greatly since living in Alaska. It's such a completely different worldview from the lower 48, and it's been just a really rewarding experience for this Southern California girl to work in Alaska, although clearly I don't respond very well to winter. So I am going to talk to you about some of the recent research that we've been doing with beluga whales in Alaska. And originally, Barb Mahoney was going to be here to give this presentation, and she couldn't be here. And so this research talk is going to be a little bit centered on the work that my lab is doing. But we are collaborating with a lot of other partners, both in and out of the state. And so you should be able to get a little bit of a broad overview of what's going on with beluga whales these days. So first, we'll just talk a little bit about basic beluga whale biology. Delphinapterus lucus is the Latin name, and it's basically two words that mean white from the Latin and from the Greek. And they are a toothed cetacean in the family Monodontidae, so they're related to narwhals. They calve in the summer, and calves are gray when they're born, and they gradually whiten as they mature, usually. It's a very interesting color change that happens with beluga whales, but it's not entirely predictable. We have seen immature animals that are completely white, and we have also seen animals that have calves who have not attained their full white color. So you can't necessarily use color to age the animals, but it's a pretty basic way of identifying age classes. They have a really varied diet, and it varies with their location. Here in Cook Inlet, beluga whales eat salmon, eulacon, crustaceans, a variety of fish species. And their diet varies not only with season, but also with location within the inlet. And we don't really know very much about their winter diet, but we'll talk about a little bit of that as we go forward. So there are five recognized stocks of beluga whales in Alaska. We have the Beaufort Sea stock, the Eastern Chukchi, the Eastern Bering Sea, Bristol Bay, and then Cook Inlet, which is, of course, where I'll be focusing my talk. One of the things that you should notice about all of the other four stocks of beluga whales is that they're all connected by open water. And so there is the possibility of immigration and emigration between those populations and genetic mixing. The Cook Inlet stock, on the other hand, is completely geographically isolated from any of the other four stocks. And so what that means also is that they are genetically distinct. So there is no mixing between Cook Inlet beluga whales and any of the other four stocks. And this is a really important point for their conservation. Cook Inlet beluga whales are also non-migratory, as you might imagine, since they're isolated. And you probably all know that they were listed as endangered under the Endangered Species Act in 2008. And so that has implications for how we do research on beluga whales, as well as the efforts that we put forward for conservation. A listing under the Endangered Species Act requires the designation of critical habitat, as you probably know. And it also requires the development of a recovery plan, the establishment of a recovery team, and so forth, so that conservation and recovery measures can be implemented. So this is the trend for the Cook Inlet beluga whale population since about 1994. So on the bottom here, we have the year from 94 to 2009 and the number of animals. And there's a couple of things that you should be able to take away from this figure. First is there's been a significant decline from an estimate of about 653 animals in 1994 down to a range roughly in the high 200s to the mid 300s since 1998. That's about a 47% overall decline in that period, so that's pretty dramatic. In the intervening years since 1999, there's a couple of things to notice here. We still have a declining trend. It's a little bit less dramatic than it was earlier, prior to 1999. In 1999, the Alaska Native community voluntarily entered into a moratorium on subsistence hunting for Cook Inlet beluga whales. They were very concerned about the decline of the population. And so in co-management agreements with the North Pacific, the National Marine Fisheries Service, they entered into that moratorium. We really expected to see a bit of a recovery pretty quickly following that moratorium, and we have not seen that. And in fact, since 2000, from about 2000 to 2010, the most recent survey in 2010 was about 340 animals, which is a little bit up from last year, but still a 1.1% per year decline in the population. And that translates to about an 80% probability of extinction within 100 years if the animals continue to decline at that rate. The other thing I'd like you to take away from this figure is the decrease in the variability around these estimates in the last 10 years. You can see here there's a lot of variability in these early estimates. We're much better now at calculating correction factors for animals that are not observed during aerial surveys, and we have much better technology, of course, for being able to count animals during these aerial surveys. And so our estimates are much more accurate now than they were in the early 90s and before. And what you see here is the distribution of the population of animals in Cook Inlet in the years 1978-79, 93-97, and 98-2008. The star, I keep losing my pointer here, the black star represents the population center. Okay, and what you'll see is, as you look at the three panels, the population center has moved further and further north into the upper reaches of the northern part of Cook Inlet. You'll also see, this is what we call a range contraction, where the distribution of animals has contracted. If we consider 1978 to 79, 100% of the habitat in the most recent surveys. By 1993 to 97, they were only utilizing 51% of that habitat. And 1998 to 2008, they're now only utilizing about 39% of the available habitat. So this range contraction has brought the population center, if you notice where that star is now, it's right at the entrance to Kinnick Arm. So the population has now clustered itself in the area of the greatest amount of human activity, human population, and coastal zone development, which under normal circumstances, we would not expect that. We would expect animals to actually move away from those centers of activity. If you look more closely at Kinnick Arm, these are data that were collected by the Marine Mammal Monitoring Program for the Port of Anchorage. This is, just for reference, this is the port here, Anchorage, and then we're going through the narrows here up into the upper part of Kinnick Arm. Now these data only represent animals that we can see from shore-based observations. So these don't represent any sort of a population estimate or the full habitat use of the animals. But it gives you an idea that these animals in the summer and the fall are really utilizing heavily the areas right around the narrows and as they move in and out of Kinnick Arm. And basically what they're doing is they're moving into the arm on the incoming tide, into feeding areas in the upper parts of Cook Inlet or of Kinnick Arm, where the salmon and Ulacon runs are. And then they go out on the ebbing tide. And these travel movement patterns of these whales are very closely tied to these fish runs. This is some work that was done by a graduate student of mine, Lee Pinney, and she was able to show that the number of beluga whale groups that were sighted, the number of beluga whale groups that were sighted during a period from May to November, which is when the monitoring program occurs at the port, you can see significant peaks in the number of beluga whale groups sighted from 2008, 2009, and 2010, just after those sockeye, coho, pink, and chum salmon runs really hit. And you can also see at the end of May, they're coming off of a peak during the Ulacon and King salmon runs. And as those runs die off, you see the number of groups that were sighted sort of decreases. In 2008, we saw one big group of 57 whales in November. So that peak is a little bit of an artifact of one big group that came in right at the end of the season. But you can see that they're really timing their movements in and out of Kinnick Arm with those fish runs. They also take advantage of the hydrologic cycles. This is an example of a figure that Lee was also included in her thesis. And all of the publications that I've referenced here are posted on the NOAA website for beluga whales. So if you're interested in looking in any more detail, you can access those. So they do travel in and out on the tides, but they also take much greater advantage of the finer hydrologic cycles in the arm than we might have otherwise thought. And basically the take-home message here is that not only do they travel in with the tide and out with the tide, but they often actually travel against the prevailing tide. So this is an example where they're actually traveling south, but on a flood tide. And what we think might be happening here is that there's a big eddy that forms right here. And you can see the red track line is beluga whale movements. And what we think is happening is that their prey are getting entrained in these eddies. And so it allows them to take advantage of their prey sort of getting stuck and allows them to get sort of a cheap and easy meal as they're leaving the arm. So they travel very predictably with the tides. They use the tides in Kinnick Arm and Greater Cook Inlet to minimize the energy that they're expending when they have to go find food. It's a very, very energetically efficient way to take advantage of those really strong tidal bores that we have in Cook Inlet. So what are the threats to cooking the beluga whales? There are many. Much like we learned with stellar sea lions, it's very hard to identify a single smoking gun when you're dealing with the decline of an apex predator. The biology and the oceanography and the chemistry in the oceans is very complex. And so with the multitude of activities that we have happening in the oceans right now, we're really most concerned about the cumulative effects of human activity on the oceans on these animals. So right now, what we know is we have not seen any fisheries mortality in recent years. So we're not seeing animals bycaught in fisheries in Cook Inlet. We're not seeing animals entangled in fishing gear like we do with fur seals and sea lions, for example. There have not been any subsistence takes since 2008. I believe there were four animals that were allowed in 2005. During a period when the population estimates were above 350. Once the population drops below 350, the moratorium kicks in again. And so that five-year average being less than 350 animals, there will not be any subsistence takes allowed until it's reevaluated in 2012. There are about 11 dead strandings per year. I know everyone wants to know about killer whale predation. Very few of those stranded animals seem to have evidence of killer whale predation, less than one per year. But they are out there, and they certainly do feed on beluga whales. We just probably don't see the evidence of all of those kills because they don't strand on shore. We do also have a lot of live strandings of beluga whales in Alaska, but not all of those are associated with mortality events. We're also concerned about chemical exposure in Cook Inlet. Some of the components that have been detected, URS has done a lot of work on this, are heavy metals like methylmercury, which are a byproduct of coal-fired power plants, PAHs, PCBs, pesticides, particularly chlorinated pesticides. So runoff is certainly a big issue. We don't have a lot of evidence at this point that animals in Cook Inlet are highly contaminated, particularly compared to some other populations like the St. Lawrence Estuary in Canada. But we have not sampled beluga whale tissues in quite a while, and so we definitely need to continue to monitor that. Human-made noise is definitely of concern. There's a lot of activity in Cook Inlet, human activity, between the Port of Anchorage expansion, the Kubota Bridge, potentially a project, oil and gas development, shipping, military activities. It's just a very busy place. And the ocean is noisy already. And so increases in anthropogenic noise, particularly in frequency ranges that are important to beluga whales and to other marine mammals, are certainly of concern. And then all of the other coastal zone development that happens. People like to live by the coast. I like to live by the coast. So the impacts of coastal zone development on habitat quality, on prey habitat quality, and so forth, water quality, are all areas of potential concern. As I said, we don't have right now the smoking gun that says this is why beluga whales are not recovering the way we expected. So I just want to mention a lot of the current research that I'm going to talk about today is a result of collaborations with many, many partners. As you know, I teach at APU. We also are partnering with NOAA NMFS, the National Marine Mammal Lab down in Seattle, the Department of Fish and Game, the Sea Life Center. We have staff from Georgia Aquarium. We've done work at Mystic Aquarium. The Port of Anchorage project is doing research monitoring as well. Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson is involved in a lot of work, and pretty much every environmental firm in town is involved in some way in beluga whale research. So there's a lot of really great work being done by a lot of really good people here in town. So I just want to touch on a few areas of research, mostly areas that I or my students have been involved in. And the first thing I want to talk about is acoustics. As I mentioned, anthropogenic noise is an area of concern for Cook Inlet beluga whales. And so one of my graduate students, Lindsay Saxon Kendall, did some work in cooperation with ICRC and the port to look at the vocal environment, the noise environment in Kinnick Arm, and look at whether or not there were any changes in detection rates of beluga whale clicks during and without construction activities at the port. So what this is what's called an LTSA, or a long-term spectral average. It's basically a sound profile that's the intensity is measured, or the frequency rather, is measured with color. And so on the bottom here you have an 8-hour time period, and then the frequency in kilohertz. Now just for point of reference, most beluga whale vocalizations are in this sort of 15 to 25 kilohertz range. And so what you'll notice here is that when construction is happening, the noise profile is very different than when there's not construction. You can see the evidence here of the noise that's going into the water during periods of construction. Now that noise is happening at around a much lower frequency range. This is primarily pile driving and in-water fill placement, I believe. So you can see there's a substantial change in the background noise in Kinnick Arm when there's construction happening. So this gives you a picture then of some of the beluga whale clicks that were detected by the arrays that Lindsay deployed in Kinnick Arm. And this is, again, the same sort of LTSA. It's a much shorter time period. This is just a few seconds. But you can see in that 20 to 40 kilohertz range, there's a marker every time a beluga whale makes a click. And then the top frame is actually the amplitude of each of those clicks. So you can see the original point where the click occurs, and then it dampens as the sound travels through water. One of the interesting things about measuring sound in water is that it travels very differently than it travels in air. It dampens much more quickly, but it travels a much further distance, particularly in deeper, colder water, which is why you hear stories about humpback whales, you know, hearing each other over tens of thousands of kilometers in the Pacific, because they use those deep ocean trenches, and their very low frequency sounds transmit a very long distance. And so they can communicate with each other over these very long distances. And obviously that communication is very important. Beluga whales are a very social species. They vocalize a lot. They have been called the canaries of the sea. And they have quite an extensive vocal repertoire. And I'll just play you a little example here. Now, this is not the vocalizations that you see on the graph. This is just a sample of some vocalizations. Those really high-pitched clicks that you hear are probably the closest to the ones that you see on the screen. So, as you can see, they vocalize a lot. They like to chatter. So, what was the results of Lindsay's thesis? Basically, she was able to show that the mean click rate, or the number of clicks per hour during construction, was lower than the number of clicks per hour without construction. Now, you can see there's quite a bit of variability here in these rates. This is a period from 1 August to 30 September 2009, and this is only the 14 days that beluga whale clicks were detected. So there is a decrease in the click rate, the detectable click rate, and that's a really important distinction. These are not statistically significant differences, which I think is probably a function of sample size for those of you who are statistically inclined. But what's important to realize here, too, is there are a couple of potential things that might be going on. They may very well be reducing the number of clicks that they emit when there's construction going on. These are acoustic data only, so we don't know where the animals are moving while these data are being collected. So it may be that they're just using a different part of Knik arm when we are when construction is happening. And we have some data from 2010 that suggests that they might spend a little bit more time on the Port McKenzie side when there's construction activity happening. It may be also that the sound that's produced from the construction activity is actually masking those beluga whale calls, although that's less likely, I think, given the frequency range that I showed you before. So definitely some potential changes in behavior associated with construction, but very, very far from being any sort of definitive answer, and we need to do a lot more work. There's some great folks from NOAA Fish and Game and University of Alaska Fairbanks that are continuing to do very sophisticated acoustic monitoring in Cook Inlet, and so I think we're going to see some really good results coming out of that very soon, and we'll have better information.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Dr. Leslie Kornick from the Department of Environmental Science at Alaska Pacific University. Her talk on recent studies surrounding the endangered belugas of Cook Inlet was recorded at the Alaska Zoo on December 14th. You can find a link to her slideshow presentation at alaskapublic.org.
So we're also interested in the energetics of beluga whales. And when I'm talking about energetics, I'm basically talking about how we know how much energy an animal requires to go about its daily business. So if you think about your daily diet, you get up in the morning, you eat breakfast, you go about your day, maybe you exercise a little bit and you burn some extra calories, and so you take in a few extra calories to make up for that. I like to reward myself with ice cream. And so at the end of the day, you either have a nice balanced energy budget and your weight stays nice and stable, or you maybe have an energy deficit and you lose weight, or maybe you have an energy surplus and you have either the ability to put on mass or you have the ability to do extra activity. And it's the same for marine mammals. And with the one exception, of course, that they hold their breath when they're doing most of this. So there's a very different way of calculating these energy budgets. So it's very difficult to measure the energy consumption of a free-ranging animal, particularly one that spends the vast majority of its life underwater. So we cooperated with the Mystic Aquarium for this project to measure the resting and active metabolic rates of their beluga whales at the aquarium. And this is work that was the master's thesis of another of my students, Jenny Godfrey. And so what we did was we used what's called open flow respirometry to measure the oxygen consumption, which is a proxy for metabolic rate, in these animals. And so you can see here, the big male Inuk is laying very nice and peacefully in this metabolic dome. And basically it's an airtight dome that rests on the water, and it's connected with this tubing to this instrument called a Fox Box, which does all kinds of fancy math and chemistry that I do not understand, and calculates the metabolic rates of these animals. And so we're interested both in the resting rates, how much energy does it just sort of take to be a beluga whale, and then we're also interested in the active metabolic rates. These animals dive for a living, and when they're out foraging, they're going up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down, holding their breath, breathing, holding their breath and breathing. And they're exerting a lot of energy while they do this. And so we had the animals at Mystic basically simulate foraging dives, swimming around the bottom of the tank and then coming up and breathing in the respirometry dome, and then going back down and swimming around again and doing this multiple times in sequence so that we could measure their active metabolic rates. They were very cooperative. It was fun. So this is an example of the kind of data that we get from the respirometer. And basically what happens is, so we have the oxygen consumption rate here in liters per minute, and this is an 8-minute period. So this is one period for the resting metabolic rate for an animal coming out and just hanging out in the dome and breathing comfortably. And it takes a few minutes for the instrument to calibrate, and then once we reach an area where we have sort of a steady state, we can take the average of all of those readings and calculate the overall metabolic rate. And then the animal leaves the dome and the machine equilibrates again. So how do our beluga whales at Mystic compare to other marine mammals? This is a little bit of a busy graph. I'm just going to point out a couple of key pieces of information. One of the ways that you can tell if the measurements that you're doing on captive animals actually mean anything is to compare them to free-ranging animals as much as possible. And there has been some work done on free-ranging animals of different species measuring metabolic rates. It's a very difficult thing to do, but we have a few successful examples of that. So on this graph, what you'll see is the mass of the animal and the metabolic rate now represented in watts. So we've translated that liters per minute of oxygen consumption into a measure of energy. And we plot it by body mass because one of the things that we know about many, many physiological adaptations and functions is that they scale allometrically with body mass. So for the most part, the bigger you are, the higher overall metabolic rate you have. Now, when you correct for body mass, that relationship flips over, and larger animals actually have lower per kilogram metabolic rates than small animals. But what we're really interested in here is just how well do our beluga whales at Mystic fit in with the predicted metabolic rates for animals of similar size. So what we have here is this black line is the BMR, and that's, how many of you in this room have heard of the Kleiber curve, anybody? Oh, very exciting, I get to teach you about Kleiber. Well, Kleiber was a really smart guy who in, I believe it was 1967 or 76, I get them mixed up, who basically developed a relationship for mammals that predicts the very basal, like the most minimal amount of energy that a mammal would require for sustaining life relative to its body mass. And what Kleiber found was that it's very, very predictable. And this is one of the ways that we figured out that some of these physiological processes scale very nicely with body mass. And so Kleiber is sort of our baseline. How do our animals compare to Kleiber? And what you'll see is pretty much all of these marine mammals, our Mystic beluga whales are these black circles, and then we have some other beluga whales in gray here that were measured in a previous study. They all pretty much fall above that Kleiber line, except for our female Mystic beluga whale. And there's a couple of possible reasons for that. There are two schools of thought. One is that all marine mammals basically have a higher basal metabolic rate than Kleiber predicts because they're in the water, and so they're constantly thermoregulating, and that takes energy. The other school of thought is that you can't really measure basal metabolic rate in a marine mammal because they're never really resting. And that's one of the requirements, is that they have to be resting. So there's quite a lot of debate still in the literature as to which of those two hypotheses is correct. But for the most part, you can see that they do fall within the range of that BMR. And this dotted line here, which is 2 times the basal metabolic rate, which is the school of thought that suggests that marine mammals tend to have a double basal metabolic rate. And then you have the 3 times basal metabolic rate line here as well, which is often associated with activity. So different types of life history processes may double or triple your metabolic rate. Things like activity, of course, growth, pregnancy and lactation, all of those things require extra energy over that basal rate. But what's interesting to see here is that our beluga whale's resting rate pretty much fall in line with the other marine mammals that resting rates have been measured in. And so that's a good check for our data. We also measured the active metabolic rate, as I mentioned, and this is a little bit of a different type of plot where we can compare the metabolic rates. The dark blue is resting, and the green here is active. And I apologize if anyone in the audience is colorblind. So we have our male Inuk here, and our female Kela. And then we have our oxygen consumption, again, in liters per minute. And just a couple of take-home messages here. Of course, the active metabolic rates are considerably higher than the resting metabolic rates, which we would expect. And then also that Enoch, our male, has a higher overall metabolic rate, both resting and active, than our female. Again, as we would expect based on that allometric scaling. So we can also plot our active metabolic rates on relative to the Kleiber curve and compare that to active metabolic rates that have been measured in other marine mammals. Different suite of species here, simply because it's very difficult to measure active metabolic rates, as you might imagine. And so we have fewer data to compare, but there's really great work being done all the time on that. And then we also have a range here that is the estimated range of what's called minimum cost of transport speed. So when animals are active and they're swimming, they are using extra energy, but there's a range of swim speeds, usually between about 2 and 3 meters per second for most marine mammals, that is the least costly in terms of energy. It's actually very costly to swim very slowly, and it's very costly, obviously, to swim really fast. So if an animal can swim most of the time in that minimum cost of transport speed range, they can conserve the most energy when they're out foraging or doing whatever else they need to be doing. So you can see our two beluga whales at Mystic fall right in between those two minimum cost of transport speeds, which is really interesting, as well as sort of, you know, falling again in that range of metabolic rates for other species that have been measured. Okay, so we're also doing a lot of work with the Bristol Bay population. We're not at this point able to capture and handle Cook Inlet beluga whales because they are so sensitive and there are so few of them. So we want to be very cautious before we do anything that might further put those animals at risk. So in collaboration with the National Marine Mammal Lab, Sea Life Center and Georgia Aquarium, and probably other partners that I'm failing to mention, we are performing comprehensive health assessments on animals in Bristol Bay, which is a stable and potentially growing population. So in this project, we are actually working with the Alaska Native hunters in Bristol Bay to capture live beluga whales and do a comprehensive health assessment. So we're taking morphometrics, which is all of your length and girth and those sorts of measurements. We're doing comprehensive blood panels, toxicology, hormones, disease and parasites. And my part of the project, as you might imagine, is energetics. And so we're looking at the energetics of blubber. And what we're hoping to accomplish with this project is two things. One, to demonstrate that we can do comprehensive health assessments without risking individual animal health and refining those techniques. And then also establishing baseline values from a healthy population so that we have something to compare if we get the opportunity to do this work in Cook Inlet. So traditionally, measuring energetics and understanding what the energy stores are that are available to an animal requires some fairly invasive sampling, which is full core blubber biopsies. And actually, beluga whales do quite well when we sample them. But in order to calculate the blubber stores for an entire animal, we need to sample across the entire animal in about 15 different locations. And clearly, doing biopsies in 15 different locations is not tenable. We're not going to do that. And so part of what I'm looking at is whether we can use high-resolution ultrasound to measure blubber stores across the animal without using those blubber biopsies. And so you can see here, we capture the whale, and we hold it in a sling. These are some folks from Georgia Aquarium and the Sea Life Center and one of my graduate students. And basically, once we get the animal in the sling, they just kind of hang out there. They do really, really well. And sometimes they vocalize, which is fun. And so what we're doing here is we're using this high-resolution ultrasound at all of these different locations across the body to measure the depth of the blubber. And the depth of the blubber allows us to then calculate the total amount of blubber that the animal has across its entire body. There's some really great fancy math that we use to do that. And the reason that we need to measure in so many different locations is because the blubber thickness is different all across the body. Just as you have a body shape that has, you know, different parts where we hold a little extra insulation, and that's true for beluga whales as well. The distribution of blubber is not constant across the body. So for this project, we are still collecting two full core biopsies so that we can actually compare and see how well the ultrasound does. And these samples are being used to measure contaminants and hormones and a variety of other things in these animals. And so what we have determined with looking at the blubber stores, you can put these in what's called a bomb calorimeter. It's a great name. And we measure the energy content in the blubber basically by blowing it up. When you combust something, it releases heat, and we can measure the amount of heat that's released and translate that into the amount of energy that's in the blubber. And blubber stores are really important for beluga whales, not only because they keep them warm in the very cold water in Cook Inlet, but also they're a very important energy store. As I mentioned, we don't know much about the winter feeding habits of beluga whales, but we do know that they don't eat a lot. There's just not very much available to them in the winter, and so they rely on those blubber stores as a ready source of energy. And so one of the things, I don't know if you can see on the picture on this screen, but so this is a full core biopsy, and this is at the skin side, and this is where it interfaces with the muscle. And as you can see, the composition, right, the color, the density of the blubber changes as you go from the skin down to the muscle layer. And that represents differences in energy content in those layers. And it's not a difference in the amount of blubber, obviously. It's a difference in the fatty acid signature. And different fatty acids have different bioavailability for an animal. And so what we found is that the energy content increases with depth based on those fatty acid signatures. The energy content is higher in whales that are fatter up front, right? So more anterior blubber. And then there are also seasonal differences in the amount of blubber based on measurements of the blubber depth, and I'll show you that in a minute. What's really interesting about this energy and content increasing with depth is if you think about the location of that blubber being right next to the muscle, right? That's closest to the inside of the animal. It's the most metabolically active, and so it's the most readily available if that animal needs a little burst of quick energy or to sustain itself over a winter where it's not feeding very often. And lo and behold, when we take the ultrasound measurements now, and this is a little busy too, again, these are ultrasound measurements from all of the different locations on the body where we measure the blubber. And so we're looking here at spring whales and fall whales and the mean blubber depth in centimeters. And basically two take-home messages here. First of all, you can see that variability in the blubber depth at different locations on the body. And then you can also see spring whales that are just coming off of a winter, having not fed very much, their blubber stores are decreased, because they've been using that ready energy to get them through the winter. And then in the fall, after they've been chowing down on salmon all summer long in Bristol Bay, those blubber stores are built back up again and are ready to get them through the coming winter. So we've also been very fortunate to be collaborating with the North Slope Borough and the Alaska Native community at Point Lay to obtain some larger samples of blubber that we can do a very controlled experiment to determine just how accurate the ultrasound is at measuring blubber depth and how accurate we are when we make our measurements on the ultrasound. So if you look at, this isn't one of our ultrasound images from Bristol Bay, and you can see this little oval here. This is where the transducer sits on the animal's skin. and it sends a sound wave and measures down to this bright white line, which is the fascia that connects the blubber to the muscle. This is one of the prettier pictures. The ultrasound images are very often difficult to interpret in terms of deciding where exactly the right bright white line is. And so we wanted to be sure that we were measuring to the correct location so that we're as accurate as we can be in measuring and calculating how much blubber an animal has. And so we were able to do ultrasound on harvested animals in Point Lay, and then take a sample, about a 2 by 2 centimeter sample of the entire blubber from skin to muscle, and be able to directly measure it with a ruler, which we can't do when we take a biopsy. We can't, you know, shove a ruler down into a live beluga whale. So this allows us to make more precise measurements and do a very controlled experiment to see how well the ultrasound does. Well, lo and behold, the ultrasound does a fantastic job of measuring blubber depth. So here we have a comparison between, for our Point Lay animals, between our ultrasound measurements and our ruler measurements. And basically what we have is almost a one-to-one correspondence of those measurements, which means that the ultrasound is a really good non-invasive way of measuring the blubber stores across the entire animal so that we can get really pretty precise calculations of the total energy stores that those animals are carrying. So this is very exciting. It's also been demonstrated in some other animals here in Alaska as well, and the technology is so amazing that we're able to carry out into the field now and be able to get really good information about these animals. So how do we put all this stuff together, especially all the energetic stuff? What does it all mean? Who cares? Well, the ultimate goal for a lot of the energetic data that I'm collecting is to develop population-level energetics models for Cook Inlet beluga whales. And, you know, a computer model is just like any other sort of a computer simulation, right? You get out what you put in. And so we're always dealing with the limits of our data and assumptions and so forth. But we can do pretty well at generating hypotheses from these models that we can then go out and test in live animals. So what we can do is we can take all of this information that we know about the BMR, which is that basal metabolic rate. There's a heat component to an energy budget, right? You're always giving off a little bit of body heat and losing that to the water. There's also an energetic cost just of digesting, right? And then we can look at the active metabolic rates that we've measured and estimate a range of active metabolic rates. And then we can plug those in to population demographic models. What's the age and size and sex structure of the population? And then we can come up with some estimates for growth. Growth is usually about 2 times the metabolic rate. We can use our blubber data to estimate seasonal blubber growth, those changes that I showed you from summer, spring to fall whales. And then we can look also at the amount of energy that's required for females for gestation and lactation. And we can sort of plug all of those into a model, do a whole lot of fancy math in a box, and come up with an estimate of how much total energy in a season or a year, whatever time scale that is appropriate for the animal, of how much energy that population needs to consume in order to remain stable and in order to increase its size. And then we can compare that to what we know about the energy density of the prey, its availability in time and space, what proportion of the energy is assimilated by the animal, what they have available in those total body blubber stores, say that 5 times fast, and that gives us an amount of energy that's available to the animal. And so we can compare those numbers and learn a little bit about whether we think the animals are experiencing an energy surplus, which then we would expect them to recover, or as we think maybe one of the issues that's happening in Cook Inlet, that they're experiencing some sort of an energy deficit, which is hampering their ability to grow population size because that takes a lot of energy to do. This is all really work in progress. There are many, many data gaps that we're still working on. We have to complete the blubber store analyses for Bristol Bay, so we're working on that. And the population modeling has yet to be done. We don't know what level of health assessments we'll be able to perform for Cook Inlet animals. There is some other modeling that we can do with what we know about Bristol Bay and the types of samples that we can collect from Cook Inlet animals that will allow us to make some comparisons without handling those animals. So we're looking at ways to accomplish that. We really know very little about the dynamics of the prey populations in Kinnick Arm. There are unmanaged fisheries for salmon and eulachon and so forth in Kinnick Arm. And so we don't really know a lot about how much prey is available, what the seasonality is. We know a little bit about the timing of those salmon runs and those eulachon runs, but we don't know much about how many are there and how many of those animals are ultimately available to beluga whales. And as I mentioned before, we really know very little about what they're doing in the winter, how much they're feeding, what they're eating, how much time they're spending in the lower portions of the inlet, what their predation risk is when they leave the more sort of protected areas of the upper inlet. So we have a lot yet to learn about Cook Inlet beluga whales in order to facilitate their recovery. Thankfully, there are a lot of good people in the state, in the agencies, in the universities, and in our local environmental firms that are doing really great work. And hopefully we'll have more answers fairly shortly. But it's an ongoing process and one that requires patience and funding, which is always an issue, of course. But I'm hopeful. I tend to be an optimist, and so I think we will learn the things that we need to learn about these animals in order to support their recovery. They're such an iconic species for Alaska and for Anchorage, and I would hate to drive down to Seward and not think I might see a beluga whale. So with that, I have many people to acknowledge who contributed to this work. And Stephanie for inviting me. Where is she back there? Hi. And I just really appreciate the opportunity to growl at you tonight. And with that, I would be happy to take as many questions as my voice will allow.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Dr. Leslie Cornick from the Department of Environmental Science at Alaska Pacific University. She was recorded at the Alaska Zoo Wildlife Wednesday Lecture Series on December 14th. Following her talk entitled New Information from Recent Studies on the Endangered Belugas in Cook Inlet, Dr. Cornick responded to questions from audience members. First, she was asked, is there any additional information on the range contraction of Cook Inlet belugas?
Not that I'm aware of. But there is a lot of really great work that's happening in Russia, in Canada. The other population of beluga whales that most closely resembles the demographics of Cook Inlet is the St. Lawrence Estuary in Canada. It's not completely isolated because it is an open water body, but it's another population that has been declining pretty dramatically. It's fairly clear that that decline is probably linked to contaminants and pollution. They have incredibly high cancer rates in those animals, and we don't see that in Cook Inlet. I don't know that those animals have experienced a range contraction the way beluga whales in Cook Inlet have. So I know that's not a very definitive answer, but as far as I know, this is the only population that we're seeing that in. And I think part of the explanation for that is simply the fact that they are, because they're isolated, there's no potential for mixing. And so you don't have the possibility for animals from other populations to come in and fill in those spaces.
Next, another audience member asked, Are there any tagging projects for Cook Inlet belugas?
There were tagging projects for beluga whales in Cook Inlet about 10 years ago or so. The tags that we put on beluga whales, we put into the dorsal ridge through that sort of soft tissue that's there. And so they migrate out of the animal over time. So as far as I know, there are no beluga whales that are currently tagged in Cook Inlet. We have 18 animals in Bristol Bay that are currently tagged. And as far as I know, all of those tags are still active.
As a follow-up, another audience member asked, why are there no tagging projects for Cook Inlet belugas? Does it have anything to do with the endangered species designation?
Well, it's not the Endangered Species Act in particular that has prevented us from tagging animals in Cook Inlet at the moment. As I mentioned, because there are so few animals in this population, we want to be very conservative about how much we handle those animals. And so right now, we are not able to get a permit to handle those animals. It's not directly related to their endangered status, but so that's why. We can't get the permit right now. Personally, I would like to be able to tag those animals because I don't think we're ever really going to get all of the answers that we need without being able to handle the animals and collect those biological samples. but I also really respect the conservative and precautionary approach that NIMS is taking right now, that they want to make sure that if we're going to handle those animals, that it's going to be a valuable exercise and one that's not going to exacerbate the problem.
Do the belugas congregate in the northern region of the Cook Inlet along Kinnick Arm in the winter or summer?
No, that's correct. They concentrate more in the upper part of the inlet and particularly in Kinnick Arm during that summer and fall time when those salmon runs are high and those eulachon runs are high. So they're up in those upper reaches of the inlet feeding in the summer and fall. And so that's where they're very concentrated, and that's where those population centers are in those panels that I showed you. They can't stay in Kinnick and Turnagain Arm during the deepest part of the winter because it's frozen over. They do come in and out. There have been observations of animals. They use the pollinias to breathe. We've seen animals during our scientific monitoring program well into November when there's a considerable amount of ice in Kinnick Arm. We don't know really what they're doing during that time because there aren't any active fish runs at that time. So they may be eating other things. They might be eating benthic crustaceans and other things that sort of hang out in the substrate. There's some suggestion that they might be using those areas to avoid predation by killer whales because they can get into areas where killer whales can't. But we don't know what they eat or how much during the winter. We only can hypothesize that they're not eating a lot because of those reductions in blubber stores from the spring.
So they do move south, but they stay close to the coast?
Yes, they do move south and they stay close to the coast. There's a program through the Port of Anchorage and also through the local NIMS office where people can call in and report beluga whale sightings. Those sightings are tracked by NIMS, so I don't have access to those data. But I know that there are occasional sightings of beluga whales throughout the arm in the winter. They're not leaving. They don't have anywhere to go in the inlet. But they tend to spend less time up in Kinnick Arm and up in Turnagain Arm and more time just in the northern part of the main Cook Inlet.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Dr. Julie Kornick from the Department of Environmental Science at Alaska Pacific University. She responded to questions from the audience following her talk on the endangered belugas of Cook Inlet. Recorded at the Alaska Zoo Wildlife Wednesday lecture series on December 14th, 2011. You can find a link to Dr. Kornick's slideshow on alaskapublic.org. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.